Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And I'm Philip Sage with the Manaway Group in Australia.
All right. Now, you've mentioned that a couple of times here, Philip, since we've been recording, since you've joined this group or started this group, I understand. What is the Manaway Group again? Because I don't think that's a household name yet.
It's not a household name, but many years ago, I lived in a small town in Ohio called Manaway, M-A-N-T-U-A. Most people pronounce it Mantua. That's how we know you're not from Manaway. And the consultancy, since the year, I think, 2001, has been operating in some form or another. And recently, we incorporated again, but this time here in Australia, not in the United States. And we offer reliability engineering asset management services. And we're now the distributor for all of the Isograph and Peak Avenue softwares.
Cool. That'll keep you busy. Yeah,
it does.
And you mentioned Peak. I've seen an ad or an ad, something like that for it, but I've no item. I've messed with them a little bit years and years ago, so they're still around. That's good. But anyway, without making this all an advertisement for the whole thing, but you mentioned that a few times and I was like, where does that come from? So thanks for answering that. I don't know if you've ever run into this. In our last discussion, we were talking about different tools and we always lead with it. People tend to use the tools or expertise they have. I was working with a startup and they had a small environmental chamber, did temperature basically. And they were making a portable car charger. So they took a couple of existing car batteries things and stuck them in a box. And then there's a whole lot of software and wiring going around it. But basically you roll it down the road and put it behind your car you want to charge and plug it in. So people could come to work and not have to have a opening in the bank of chargers. They'd had two or three of these little carts that a staff would roll out and charge your car for you kind of thing. I thought, okay, it's a cool product. I don't know whether it still exists or not, but one of the discussions I had with them was concerning an exposed set of lugs that they were debating whether to coat them or not. And I was advocating they did because I knew they were going to work in humid environments that would have condensation. And so the senior engineer said, well, we've got an environmental chamber. Let's throw the board in there and see what happens. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. Well, the chamber was desiccated air, heated up and thrown into a box. It was just a thermal chamber.
Like, what does that do?
Yeah, it's going to make some hot copper, and that's about it, but it's not going to do anything. It's like there was a disconnect between the question we were trying to answer, but it was the default was, oh, we have a chamber, let's throw it in there.
Mm-hmm.
And okay. Let's pull back a little bit. Let's connect the dots here. What question are we trying to answer? Will humidity and condensation cause a problem with these two electrodes being close together with high current voltage on it? And I suggested the inclusion of humidity and condensation may be a contributing factor to it. And they all agreed that moisture around open leads is probably not a good idea, especially with a little pollution around it. And then you said, and his defense was, but we have a chamber.
Mm-hmm.
So why don't we use it?
Yeah. But what does the chamber do? Is it the right tool at the right time? And is it helping test the problem that you're trying to prevent from occurring? And, conformal coated circuit boards are, pretty good, and they're pretty prevalent on safety valves and other things that you find in petrochemical mm-hmm. refinery. That's especially those in the Middle East that operate in very sandy, dusty environments. They serve not so much from the moisture protector, but from the deposit of dust and the development of short circuits and other things. So I think the key that, you know, especially if you're working with a new group, is to really have that honest discussion about what's our problem, and then how do we test it, rather than just, you know, it's great that you have an environmental chamber, but does that environmental chamber do anything other than cost you energy and waste time in the cycle of development to test for something that you weren't going to be able to test for with that piece of equipment anyhow?
Well, the issue gets bigger than that. I was talking to a vendor in a company that was trying to sell them a socket for some ASICs. And it was a novel design of these springed leads, these little like pogo sticks is kind of what they look like, kind of thing. And they had little springs in them. So they would make a decent contact force or normal force on a contact. And the question I always ask suppliers is, so how does it fail? Now, most of them don't ever want to answer that question. and if they would have said, you know, there's a chance for some fretting, and there might be a contaminant blocks it, you know, or vibration will give it intermittence. I expected corrosion over many, many years, you know, something. And then my next question is, how do you know? You know, if they're just quick on their feet and making it up, then the second question catches them out with that. But this guy said, oh, it's never failed. This is, and then he went into how many thousands they've shipped and blah, 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 and all this other stuff. And like, what do you mean it never fails? I had a sample going around the table. It says, this pogo stick stuck. Is that a failure? It's not going to, you know, make contact. It's going to either punch through or just be proud and not make anything. And he goes, I've never seen that before, which is one of the five standard answers when you have a problem with a vendor. I've never seen that before. You must have broken it. You know, it's your bad design, you know, your manufacturing process or something like that. And Dick Moss used to tell me that he's where I got that, the five standard answers from suppliers. And the fifth one was, oh, it's ESD, you know. And I had a problem. I hadn't even put it in the mail yet. And he goes, oh, it's ESD. Says, one, ESD is really, really hard to find damage. And you haven't even gotten the product yet. And I can see an evidence here that it's probably not ESD. There's not a pinhole. It's a whole lot different than that. The crystal actually broke. I don't think ESD. Yeah. So, but anyway, they, this notion of what I see from vendors, and getting back, I got off track there a bit, is that he also cited that, oh, we tested to IEC this and SANT that and DYX somebody else numbers, and he went down this long list. I says, what has any of those got to do with it? It's going to have a consistent electrical contact on every pin. And he goes, well, the standards haven't caught up yet, but these are the closest, and they all pass, so that must be good.
Be mindful that often the person that you're dealing with is the salesman or saleswoman.
Yeah, and this was a sales engineer. I expected
sales engineer. Yeah, and may not be privy to all of the testing information that's gone on and the failure modes and effects analysis. The DFMEA one was performed, which in today's world, for any manufactured part, you're pretty certain that that should probably be out there. But getting that information, finding the right person in the organization, you know, of a, for example, of extremely large internet switch manufacturer, may have an engineering department spread across several countries and time zones. And the testing, the type of information that you're trying to surface may not be available or even known to the person who you're talking with. So it is, you know, it is a challenge. And the key is to make sure that what you're trying to test for is going to work. Now, I did see a pretty good group up in Queensland. I guess it was about 6 months ago, they invited us up to see their testing laboratory that they'd built everything from scratch at a local energy company. And they did have environmental chambers that did also do moisture salt water, salt exposure. Mm-hmm. And they pulled and showed us some manufacturer's parts that had been in the environmental chamber for a month, and they looked like they were just about to rust through in a couple of them, and others that same function, same part was actually performing very, very, very well. And a few parts that they said that they went back to the manufacturer and the manufacturer went back to their supplier, and they found out that they had supplied the wrong material. So, you know, it's really, really important to have that level of dedication. These guys were in the electricity business, distribution and transmission at high voltages, and they had built the capability to test every new manufactured component that went onto their network, simply because they were driven by the frustration of having so many things go wrong. So it's important to understand what you're testing, and making sure that the test is going to mimic real life, and that you're not testing to something that doesn't matter, never going to happen with your particular product, or has a minimal consequence that if it does happen, it doesn't really matter.
Well, like the example you said, a lot of these transmission lines are near coastal areas. So salt fog is a real condition, but if you're making something to go on a satellite in space, there's not a whole lot of reason to have salt fog unless you're worried about the shipping and transport of it to get it to the launch pad.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's connect. But I think that's the key, is the piece that's missing is connect what you're going to test, not based on what you have or what you have available to you or what's easy to test or is a standard that you can say, hey, we passed this standard, but to what information or what question are you trying to answer? This company is saying, all right, we have three suppliers. We have these, insulators or isolators or whatever they're called. And then we'll put them through our battery of environmental conditions that we know exist for our products where we install these things and see which one works and then figure out why and understand it. And then if none of them work, then what do we need to do different? How do we specify this so we get the part we need? But they needed information. So they created the test beds and sequences and materials and processes to answer those questions for them. And that goes back to that original story and I've seen it so many times. The default was, oh, we have a chamber, let's throw it in there. Or, we have this test, let's do that. Or we have a microscope, let's look at it. We need to decapitate it first decap it first so we can, and then we're going to need a much better than a tabletop optical scope to see where it's going on. Part of it is that similar to what we talked last time, it says, oh, but we have that tool, let's use it, versus what are we trying to answer? What question or what information do we need? I try to take advantage of any disaster as being a learning opportunity. I didn't have the patience to say, I already knew if we put it in a dry chamber, this isn't going to do anything. So why bother? And that was the frustration part. These were smart engineers for the fields they're in, but testing wasn't expertise area for them or even an area they cared much about. It's like, and there's all kinds of reasons for that, but it was that question that sit, stand back and have that short discussion about what are we really trying to do here? What's the problem we're trying to answer? It reminds me of fishbone diagrams, right? What are all the possible ways to go? And which are the ones that are likely to occur, but we can check real easy. Let's get the low hanging fruit out of the way and go, no, can't do that. That's not going to be a problem. That's an issue. And what's left is probably where the real problem is. And then we got to spend some money and go evaluate that. But it's this a related mindset, and there's probably names like Murphy's Law kind of names for some of this, is like the guy, and you've been there, you get in the room and there's a failure analysis kicking off and some crotchety old guy unrelated to you or I goes, oh, I know what the problem is. I can solve this right away, and leaves, and it's going to go solve it. And sometimes they get it right. But 9 times out of 10, I found that the problem re-exists real quick. They're fixing a symptom and not the problem.
Yeah. The shotgun approach, right? Come in and change everything. And maybe hopefully the problem will go away.
Yeah.
I've been parts of, you know, that in my term in the steel business, where we would have a problem with the rolling mill, and management's shotgun approach was to go in and change all the components in the rolling mill, and at great expense and great effort, and the problem still persisted. Yeah. So we were looking in absolutely in the wrong place, but hoping, really hoping beyond hope. And the right test at the right time. You mentioned space, and I did work once on a satellite. I had a tertiary role, but was part of the development team of a satellite called Andy, A-N-D-E, that was launched by the shuttle and tumbled around the Earth for several days, and gathered information and then re-entered and was burned up, and that was the end of it. But they had decided that one of the tests that it had to pass in order to go on to the shuttle was an environmental heat test. So they put it in the oven, set the temperature, and left it for the weekend, and came back and realized that both of the thermocouples in the oven had failed, and the oven went full on for the weekend, and there was nothing but a pile of ash left.
Oh, wow. Luckily, it didn't burn the building down.
Yeah, the circuit boards were built by the midshipmen at the Naval Academy, and they were able to build another set fairly quickly and get that down and get it retested. But I said, you know, as you were mentioning, is it the right test? Does it matter? And you sit there and go, well, really, do I need to oven test a satellite that's going to tumble in space where the temperature is either, you know, low, or when it's in the sun, maybe high? And I guess the answer is probably you do. But what were we trying to, what was the goal of that test? And I was too far away from the center of the design team to really to understand that type of question, and was really looking, working on the antenna system, which it was using to communicate.
Well, when you go deep in downhole and oil exploration, or under the hood of a car, or in space, a lot of what we know in the lab, behind our workstation area, you know, in our design labs, or in our cubicle someplace, the laws of physics still work, yet they're very different behaviors. Mm. For example, you can't assume heat's going to rise in space, because there's nothing to rise in. There's no air there.
Correct.
You know, so you get this little bubble of heat that just doesn't go away, or somebody's breathing and now they have a little bubble of carbon dioxide or carbon dioxide around them, and there's not enough oxygen. So they have all these fans blowing all over the place to keep the air mix circulating. Stuff like
interesting.
That.
Interesting.
And, but there's a space example I was working with the team. I was teaching a class on reliability with the team at NASA. And one of the people there said she was working on, should we use LEDs instead of fluorescent light bulbs on the space station?
Oh, wow.
You're like, okay. But all of the celestial type evaluations of that have to be couched with what they know happens to, like, heat transfer or just flow, or what's available in the environment, and pressure differentials, and all these different things that go into it. And will it survive the launch, which is not a pleasant ride for anybody?
No.
And the sound shock alone, and all these different factors. And they said, so we know a lot about the environment, and sort of like your example with that, electrical transmission lines, they know a lot about their environment, and they knew what they were looking for. But can you imagine the first shipment up to space, the first manned rocket, and they needed to have a light. So they just put in a light bulb. They probably didn't give it a second thought. And it, you know, and it worked. So it was like, but why? How? You know, this thinking through all of the ramifications of how a light bulb works and the details of it. And then, oh, we're going to change the source to an LED. Is a lot of those same assumptions, do they apply anymore? Or do they still work? Or how do we know? And
yeah, I think you have to. And I did have the good fortune in at one point in my career, I was working at NASA at Glenn Research Center in Cleveland, and had access to all of the different test chambers and the very large vibration shakers for simulating the launch vibration. And
oh yeah, you don't want to stand on that.
Yeah, microgravity tunnels for testing how things work, and microgravity by dropping it into a hole that been bored into the earth, 500 or 1,000 feet deep. So for a short period of time, the gravity, is the effects of gravity are very minimized while you're dropping an object.
Well, just to, how did they, because they must have done something to the air, made it a vacuum. Otherwise you'd have all these differential forces on it just from its falling against the atmosphere.
Yeah. And at the bottom, was a bunch of, best way to describe them would be styrofoam BBs and the cushion to blow the stop. And then you would hoist at the top. So, it's, the wind tunnels, especially for aviation, and the engine research buildings for ramping engines up and down under controlled conditions, all of those things have to be tested before you move them into an environment. And all of that is, of course, vital in the development of the design and the fielding of the first prototypes, whether it's for aviation or space or some other application underwater, perhaps in the submarine fleet.
Yeah, it's failure analysis I've been preaching for a long time. Start with the problem. You need to understand the problem first. It's, avoid jumping to solutions. But I think that applies more broadly, is that just because you have a chamber, it's not the solution for everything. Just because you regularly are set up to do some standard test that you don't even know how to interpret isn't going to answer your question for you. But I see this with, we're going to do HALT. We'll always do HALT. And I'm like, okay, why? If you can't answer that question, don't do the test. And I also ask the question in many organizations is, all right, who needs the results of this to make a decision? Right. Who needs this? Oh, but we always do this. Okay. Doesn't matter who gets the results. Well, if my boss sees we don't do the test, he gets mad at me. He says, well, let's go talk to your boss. Who needs the results of this test? Well, it's just on the checklist. Who needs the results of this test? You're going to spend $100,000 running this thing. And if nobody's going to use that information, you're wasting money and time and resources. And but it's on the list. And like, all right, let me go talk to your boss until I find somebody that cares.
It's an interesting challenge. And of course, the design cycles are shrinking more and more every day. And the pressures are there to not test in some cases.
Which can be justified. It really can be. If you got great analytics and great understanding and great background in history, I can be convinced. I'm not a test first, but if you are going to do a test, or if you're going to run an experiment, it goes back to, I think, junior high. We used to do science fairs and stuff, even grade school science fair. Well, what's your hypothesis? Start with what information are you trying to get? And it could be an analysis. It could be ask the guy in the next cubicle. It could be run a test, but start with what you need and then figure out what to go do. Just because you have a chamber doesn't mean you're set.
Yes. The right test at the right time, at the right depth of penetration.
There you go. Sounds like our last episode. We might have to copyright one or both of them. But if you're listening to this, do you know what I mean? Let us know if this rings a bell with you. If you've run into the handful of people that say, oh, but just throw it in the chamber. We'll be fine. We'll see what happens. Or something of similar phrasing. And then what have you done about it? What kind of activities or ideas or situations have helped you break through it? We're suggesting just back up and say, you know, what are you trying to solve here? What are you trying to learn here? That kind of stuff. And will you get there? But let us know. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And you can find a couple of ways to get in touch with us. One of which we've only had one person use years ago, which they can leave us a video or an audio recording, and we can actually then use it on the show. Maybe that scares away most people. But Philip and I are available, like the other hosts of the show, through LinkedIn and our About pages. So plenty of ways for you to get in touch. And we went through a whole bevy of inputs and comments and questions earlier this year, and we're running a little low on that. So if you've got anything on your mind, let us know. We'd love to hear from you.
All right.
Is that a good enough episode, the right place at the right time, the right show at the right time?
The right show at the right time. There you go. Make a t-shirt. Print them up.
All right. Thanks, Phil.
My pleasure.
We'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.